Let me just dedicate today's shiur to the memory of Leah Bas David Chai HaKohen. That is the mother of Mrs. Mimi Samuels, and we thank you for sponsoring the shiur and for helping our Torah programming go forward. We hope that our Divrei Torah that we share today should be a Ilui HaNeshama for her, and all the Divrei Torah that come about as a result of your help and your sponsorship should be a Ilui for her Neshama. We continue with our discussion in Pirkei Avos, and we are up to the Mishnah about Shmaya v'Avtalion. So I really want to focus on two different sections of this Mishnah. We're not even going to get through the whole thing this morning. We're going to save some of it for next week or possibly the following. But it's all okay. There's a lot to talk about. Hafochba v'hafochba dekulaba. There's always something to learn from every aspect and every area of Torah, and this is no exception. So we begin with just the very personality that authored this Mishnah. And that is Shmaya v'Avtalion. Who was Shmaya? Avtalion we'll talk about maybe next week. But Shmaya and Avtalion were best of friends. And they lived in the time of the second Beis HaMikdash. They lived right before the Churban Beis HaMikdash. And they were living at a time when the leadership of the Jewish community was split into two parts. Not because they were enemies, but because there was shared responsibility. There was the Nasi, who served as one major part of the leadership, and then there was the Av Beis Din. He ran all of the judiciary aspects of the Jewish community, and these were the two closest partners and friends who would work together in leading the Jewish people. That was Shmaya and Avtalion. They lived at a time when there was tremendous controversy. They lived at a time when there was great tension and hostility between the community that we refer to as the Tzedukim and the community that we refer to as the Prushim. Now, ironically, what this was all about was in the times of the second Beis HaMikdash, there were deviant groups who decided to depart from traditional Orthodox practice, and they decided they were going to go off on their own and start a new movement. They did not accept, they did not believe in Torah Shebaal Peh, and they decided they were going to observe mitzvahs the way they felt is the proper way to do so. And this became a major faction of the Jewish community, so much so, they gained so much power, that they ultimately were serving as the Kohanim Gedolim in the times of the second Beis HaMikdash. So they were not just a minority who was off to the side. They became a very big following, and this always was a point of great tension because the Nasi and the Av Beis Din were always from the traditional part of the Jewish community, and often you had a Kohen Gadol who somehow made his way in there who was not at all in line with the way they wanted the Beis HaMikdash to run. And this was a very difficult time, but this was the time in which they lived. It's interesting to note that the Tzedukim were the ones who went off and they were followers of Tzaduk. That's why they were called the Tzedukim. But the traditional Jews were referred to as the Prushim. Anybody who knows Hebrew, what does Parush mean? Separate. Parush means to separate. Now, we, the Orthodox traditional Jews, did not separate. We stayed the same. You're the ones who separated. So this really was a derogatory term that was given by the Tzedukim against the rest of the traditional Jews. They referred to them as the Prushim. You're the ones who veered off, even though we were the ones who veered off. And it's interesting that that's the way it goes down in history, as the two camps are the Tzedukim and the Prushim, even though it's really a strange way to refer to it. Somebody told me last night that apparently Rabbi Mati Neuberger just said a story in the White Shul about Hermann Wouk, that once he was at a conference and somebody came over to him and said, "How are you still an Orthodox Jew? I don't really understand. Why have you veered off from the way of the rest of the world?" And he said, "I haven't veered off. All of you have veered off. I stuck to the way that traditional practice is supposed to be experienced." And he said, "All the rest of you have veered off." So I'm sure the story is probably better than that. And he was so prolific, and I'm sure he had a great line. But that's the gist of the story that I was told third or fourth hand last night after the shiur. And it's a very beautiful story. And that's the story of the Tzedukim and the Prushim, in essence. That was the time period in which Shmaya v'Avtalion lived. So much so, the Gemara Maseches Yuma tells us about an experience, an encounter that happened. The Medrash writes it was on Yom Kippur. So imagine, the most exciting day of the year in the Beis HaMikdash was Yom Kippur. It's ironic that everybody was so excited, but that's what happened. So Yom Kippur was really an amazing festivity. That's the day when the Beis HaMikdash was filled, and everybody was watching how the Kohen Gadol would do all the Avoda, and they would follow him. So after the Avoda was finished one year, there was a whole group of Jews who decided they were going to escort the Kohen Gadol out of the Beis HaMikdash, and they were celebrating all the Avoda that was done in the proper way. And as they're doing all of this, they notice out of the corner of their eyes that Shmaya va'Avtalion are there in the back of the crowd. And they say to themselves, hey, why are we celebrating the Kohen Gadol? We should really go and give respect to Shmaya va'Avtalion. They are the leaders of the Jewish community. So they all leave the presence of the Kohen Gadol, and they go to Shmaya va'Avtalion. Obviously, the Kohen Gadol was hurt by that, and Shmaya va'Avtalion felt that it was their duty to go over to the Kohen Gadol and to ask him for a bracha, to show their respect to him. And they did. And the Kohen Gadol had a very disrespectful remark back to them, basically saying, you are Gerim, and therefore you are unworthy the way that I am. I am the child of Kohanim. I am the Kohen Gadol, and you are just Gerim. And he spoke in a very derogatory way to them, and the Gemara describes what they responded. But the truth is, the Gemara tells us in Maseches Gittin that really Shmaya va'Avtalion were converts. Either they converted or they are the child of a convert, but they were not born into a Jewish family from the way the tradition has it. And that is an amazing statement. It's an amazing statement that Shmaya va'Avtalion, who seemingly were Gerim, they were converted, and they did not grow up as a part of the Jewish religion, rose and elevated themselves ultimately to become the two most prominent leaders of their generation. They were the Nasi and the Av Beis Din. So they were descendants from Sancheirev. The Psukim and Sefer Melachim tell us that Sancheirev was the child of Melech Ashur. Ashur is Assyria. So he had a child by the name of Sancheirev. At some point, Sancheirev tried to lay a siege on Yerushalayim. And then the Navi tells us in great descriptive detail how his entire army was wiped out in a miraculous feat. Whatever it was, the historians say it was, they all got the flu and they died from it. The Navi says, basically, God performed a tremendous miracle and all of them died in one night. I think it says over 100,000 soldiers. I don't know if that's an exaggeration, but I think that's what the Navi says, something around that. But basically, that is Sancheirev. And he has a child and he has descendants that later on rose to become part of the Jewish community, and they were ultimately Shmaya va'Avtalion. This is not the only place in Jewish history where we find very outstanding and notable distinguished leaders who were Gerim. One of them, obviously, as we know, is Rus HaMoavia, who becomes the mother of royalty. She's the mother, ultimately the ancestor of David HaMelech and the Mashiach. That is Rus HaMoavia. She comes from the community of Moab, where the Torah says, Lo Yavo Amoni Umoavi B'Kahal Hashem. Generally, we're not even supposed to accept somebody from the community of Moab. Rus was an exception. The Gemara says, Amoni velo Amonis, Moavi velo Moavis. A man is not allowed to come in and convert, but a woman is, whatever the exception is. But basically, look what happened. Rus becomes a convert, and look what the result is. She has David HaMelech, and ultimately the Melech HaMashiach. Ovadia HaNavi. Ovadia is actually the shortest of all the Sifrei HaNavi. It only has one perek, one chapter, and I believe it's maybe 20 or 30 psukim. That is the nevuah that he was given. And Ovadia, we're told, was a convert. Ovadia was not a Jew. Ovadia later on converted, and then he had a nevuah. And why was he zocha to have a nevuah? Why did God choose him? So the Navi says, because when all this story was going on with Achav and Izebel, and they were killing Jews, and there was terrible persecution, he, Ovadia, who was part of that whole regime, decided to be a kind-hearted human being and save a bunch of Jews. He hid them in a cave. He did not allow for them to be disclosed. And because of that, Zacha l'nevuah. So you have Ovadia HaNavi, who is an immortal figure for us. He is forever recognized as one of the Sifrei HaTanach, was also a very distinguished personality in our history who came not as a Jew originally in his life, but he ultimately converted and grew up to be the great Navi Ovadia. Rabbi Akiva, as we know, also was probably the greatest of the Tanaim, if you can say such a thing. What he accomplished was tremendous, and Rabbi Akiva also was known to be from Mishpachas Gerim. So that is a very important point to think about. I'm going to focus on it in a minute, but there is a great halachic challenge that comes along with that as well. On the one hand, we know the mitzvah of Ve'ahavtem es Hager. The Torah says we need to be kind, we need to be compassionate, we need to be sympathetic to the ger. Doesn't mean you treat the ger like a nebuch, like a subpar. To the contrary, you need to be welcoming. Va'ahavtem es hager. Sometimes a person who is new to a community. And the Sefer Achinuch, I believe, writes that this is not only about somebody who actually converts from being a non-Jew to ultimately being a Jew, but va'ahavtem es hager means also if you have somebody who moves into a new neighborhood. I am also in some way a ger. I also don't recognize the community. I don't know the ins and outs. I don't fully understand how the community works, what the politics are, who I should stay away from, who I should be involved with, where the pizza shops are, where the mikveh is. Those are all very important things to know when you move into a community. And sometimes it takes a person a while to acclimate themselves. And says the Sefer HaChinuch, that is all part of the mitzvah of Ve'ahavtem es hagir. When somebody is a little bit out of place, until they're able to acclimate themselves, it is our job as the resident to make sure that they are made to be comfortable, and whatever that takes. So I remember the first couple of years that we were living here, we still are the first couple of years, but I guess the first couple of years. So my wife went out of her way whenever there was a young couple that moved into the neighborhood. She would send them out a whole listing of kosher restaurants, which then became way too long, and a whole listing of where the mikveh is and what the hours are and what the phone number is and all just the things that maybe you would be uncomfortable to ask. Like, you know, some people might not want to ask about who the doctors in the neighborhood are, who the pediatricians are. They don't know who to ask. Maybe I'm offending someone. So if you help somebody out like that, that is the mitzvah of Ve'ahavtem es hager. Very simple thing to do, but a very important thing that could be helpful to people. So on the one hand, we have a mitzvah of Ve'ahavtem es hager. On the other hand, the Gemara says, there are limitations and there are restrictions of what kind of position a ger is allowed to hold in the Jewish community. Very strange halacha, but the Rambam quotes it from a Gemara Maseches Kiddushin, and I will read you what the Rambam says. Ein ma'amidim melech mekahal gerim. When it comes time for the Jewish people to appoint a king and to decide that somebody is going to be their leader, that person cannot be mekahal gerim. That person cannot be from a family of converts. V'lo l'malchus bilvad, and the Rambam says this doesn't apply only to the king, who is the ultimate leader. Ela l'chol seroros should be Yisrael. This applies to any position of leadership, the Rambam says, that any Jewish community needs to appoint. Lo sar hatzava, he says, not the general of the army, not even the nasi, he says, that cannot be something, that cannot be a position that is held by a convert. And the question that many are bothered with is, how do you explain Shmaya v'Avtalion? They were from a family of Gerim, and they obviously should not have been chosen to be the nasi or the Av Beis Din. How did we violate the rule that the Gemara says very explicitly in Maseches Kiddushin, as well as the Rambam writes it lehalacha, that we are not supposed to appoint somebody who is a convert? And if you think this is just a discussion that is relevant to 2,000 years ago in the times of the Beis Hamikdash, when they had a Nasi and an Av Beis Din, it is extremely relevant today as well. Rav Moshe Feinstein writes, imagine you have a community who looks for a new rabbi, just for argument's sake. So you have all kinds of candidates who are going to give in their candidacy, and we have all kinds of questions. We have a vetting process that we want to go through to decide who is the appropriate choice for our community. Now, when you have that kind of discussion, I would imagine everybody has their own version of what is important to find in a rabbi and what is not. But probably one of the questions that we would not ask on the Shabbos when the rabbi comes to try it out, we would probably not inquire whether or not he is a convert, or whether or not his grandparents were converts. I would imagine that wouldn't even dawn on anybody to ask such a question. We would look whether or not this candidate is qualified. Does he know how to do the job properly? Does he know how to do everything that our community needs? And if not, you don't belong here. And if yes, you do belong here, and we don't care who your grandparents were. I would imagine most of us would agree. But Rav Moshe says in a tshuva, do we have to start thinking about whether or not we have to look into this? And Rav Moshe has a lengthy discussion about it. And one of the things that he says is, we have this conflict. On the one hand, Ve'ahavtem es hager, which is of supreme importance. On the other hand, he says, the Gemara says we have some kind of restriction. And what many Achronim write is, if this is the person who is the most worthy candidate, for whatever reason, whatever the metrics are going to be for measuring how worthy a person is or is not for whatever position you have open, in such a case we would say, if you are the best candidate, or we get this question all the time, principals of a school, that is a position of leadership, a very powerful position of leadership, and we need somebody who's overly qualified to do the job. Not everybody knows how to be a principal, and not every educator knows how to then transition into the administrative role either. So sometimes we need to look out of the box and find somebody who knows how to really be a principal. Well, do we have to really find out whether or not they are from a family of Gerim? And what Rav Moshe Feinstein writes is, if you feel that they are the best candidate after looking into everybody else, then he says you have every right to take them. When the Rambam says, again, it's a lot more of a nuanced discussion than that, I'm oversimplifying his tshuva, But what Rav Moshe says is, when the Rambam tells us that you are not allowed to take a ger for a position of leadership, that means if I have two equal candidates, and I can just as easily make the king somebody who comes from a lineage of Jews, or somebody who comes from a family of gerim, then the Rambam says it wouldn't be appropriate to take the ger over the other candidate. However, it's clear, says Rav Moshe, if the principal that we think should be hired is the one who has the right qualifications and will do the job in the best way, that's the person who should be hired, and it doesn't matter where they come from. And I think that is a very important point to walk away with from the story of Shmaya v'Avtalion. It makes no difference who our parents may be or may not be. I have to say, maybe I think about this more than other people do, for obvious reasons. But it's something that I think is worthy of our consideration. So the story is told about a prominent Jew who lived in the town of Vilna. And Vilna at the time in Europe was a very important, a bustling city. And he traveled to Brisk every couple of months, because in Brisk lived the great Beis Halevi. Beis Halevi was one of the Gedolei Ador, one of the leaders of the generation. And this Jew from Vilna was very involved in the local municipality and all the issues that went on. And he said, you know, every few months I should go out of my way to visit the Beis Halevi and speak over with him the issues that came up over the last few months, so I will know how to properly guide my community. So he comes and he has an extensive conversation with the Beis Halevi. And after they have this whole discussion, the Beis Halevi turns to him and he says, you know, I have a request of you. When you go back to Vilna, after you get home, I ask that you start spending a considerable amount of time with those members of your community who are homeless. And he said, from here on in, any questions, any polemics, any disputes that may arise in Vilna, I suggest that you discuss it with them. And he was so troubled by this request of the Beis Halevi. And he couldn't understand. Do you really believe that the homeless members of our community are going to be able to give a nuanced perspective? Are they going to really understand the sensitivity of the issues that go on in Vilna? How am I going to discuss with them when they don't even know what it means to be a homeowner, when they don't even know what it means to be a contributing member of the society in our community? It doesn't make sense. I should go and discuss with them the issues that we have in Vilna? What do you mean? So he finally musters up the courage and he says, Rabbi Beis Halevi, I don't understand. I'm supposed to spend time with those who are homeless? I get it. I'll do chesed. I'll help them out. But you expect that in the future I'm going to consult with them when an issue comes up? It doesn't sound like it makes any sense. And the Beis Halevi said, I'll explain to you what I mean. When we say Hallel, one of the psukim in Tehillim that we mention is, Beis Aaron Baruch Hu Es Hashem, Beis Halevi Baruch Hu Es Hashem. And then we end off and we say, Yirei Hashem Baruch Hu Es Hashem. Writes the Beis Halevi, you'll notice that there's one difference between those three categories. When we refer to the children of Aaron, to the family of Kohanim, and to the family of Leviim, we refer to them as the Beis Aaron and the Beis Halevi. When we refer to somebody who is a Yarei Hashem, somebody who has Yiras Shamayim, we don't call that person somebody who comes from the Beis Yirei Hashem. Because there is no home that can assure that you will be a Yarei Shamayim. If you are born into a prestigious family, like the Aaron HaKohen's family, or into the family of Leviim, by nature of the fact that you were born to those parents, you are a Kohen or a Levi. You have that elevated status. But if you want to know how to live life as a Yarei Shamayim, that is never going to help you just because you may have come from a family who may have been Yarei Shamayim. That makes no difference. The job of a Yarei Shamayim is to exert energy through the experiences of life and come to an understanding of what it means to be a Yarei Shamayim on your own. And that goes in both directions. It means, if my parent is or was a great Yarei Shamayim, it is no guarantee that I will be. It is a challenge that I need to deal with, that I need to work on, and that I need to develop on my own, a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu that is meaningful. And it has nothing to do with my parents. On the other hand, it means, in the positive, if my parents had no idea, had no inkling of what it means to be a Yarei Shamayim, I have the opportunity to build and elevate myself. Look at Shmaya v'Avtalion. Look what they accomplished. Look who they became. And they did not come from the base Yirei Hashem. They were not raised with this. And yet a person has the opportunity in life to be able to accomplish that and to be able to do that. Every day in our Psukei Dezimra, we recite the Az Yashir. Obviously, that's from Chumash, that's from the Torah. After the Jewish people crossed over the Yamsuf, So we know that they then had this incredible revelation, and they started to sing Az Yashir Moshe B'nei Yisrael. And one of the psukim that we recite is Ze Keli Ve'anveyu Elokei Avi Ve'arom Emenhu. Obviously, it means, the simple understanding is, we are going to glorify our God. But one of the Talmidim of the Baal Shem Tov, Reb Meir Primishlana, he was one of the most famous Talmidim of the Baal Shem Tov, writes that in truth, this pasuk is really addressing two divergent groups of people. And who are they? He said there are some people who spend their entire lives pursuing, exploring, trying to understand, how can I become closer with HaKadosh Baruch Hu? How can I develop a relationship with Him? And that is their lifelong mission, to uncover and to discover the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in their lives. Until they come to a point where they are able to say, Zeh Keli, I can say that God actually means something to me. I would venture to say, if we would ask 90% of the people in this room, what does God mean to you? I probably would imagine most people would not know what to say. Think about it. What does God actually mean to me? Well, I daven every day. Okay, that's the way that you express yourself to Him, but what does God mean to you? What role does He play in your life? Most of us, I believe, wouldn't be able to answer that question when we were asked, Zeh Keli, are you able to point to an aspect of your life and say, yes, God means X, Y, or Z to me. God actually has a major presence in my life. Writes the Baal Shem Tov, his Talmud writes, that there are those people who are able to say at some point after a whole lifetime of trying to make this discovery and build this relationship, they can say, Zeh Keli, yes, God means something to me, tangible. That is Va'anveyu, that is unbelievable, that is incredible. And there are other people, he says, who live their entire lives just thinking about Elokei Avi. How many people have you met who spend their entire lives talking about, my grandparents in Europe were such great tzaddikim, and you should have seen how my grandmother used to light the Shabbos candles, and every week she would cry as she was standing in front of the candles, davening for her children, and my grandfather never used to carry in the Eruv, and my grandfather, you should have seen, he wore the gartel and the bekasha and the strimal and the whole thing, and you should have seen when my grandfather came to the Pesach Seder, he used to eat not the fake maror that we all eat today that we get away with, he used to eat the real deal, and he would sit there and grate it. And we talk so much about our grandparents, and I sometimes wonder when I hear these stories when people talk about it, well, how much have all these memories impacted the life that you live? What do I care how great your grandfather was? You don't seem so great yourself. And I'm talking very personally. I can spend my entire life talking about my great father, but of what good is that? What does that mean for me? What does it do for me? Nothing. Nothing at all. You can spend an entire life looking at Elokei Avi, the God of my parents, the God of my grandparents, and sometimes you can get stuck in that because it has made absolutely no impact or impression on the life that you are living now. And you don't measure up at all in any way to these memories that you have of your grandparents. It has not impacted your life in any substantial way. That is the person who lives the Elokei Avi experience. My father always told us when we grew up, and it's ironic that he told it to us, he's such a humble person for anybody who knows him, so he never clearly made the association, but if you read between the lines, you understood what he was saying. The Gemara says in Maseches Sanhedrin that when a king becomes the Melech, one of the first jobs that he has to write a Sefer Torah. He has to commission the writing of a Sefer Torah, V'karabo kol yemei chayav, and he needs to read from that Sefer Torah every day of his life. He must seek guidance from the words of the Torah throughout every juncture of his life. Not only that, the Torah says he has to have two Sifrei Torah. Achas sheyotzeis v'nechneses imo. One is that is always going to be available to travel with him. A king very often has to go out of his palace to do different things for the community. So there's a Sefer Torah that is reserved to always travel with him. And the second Sefer Torah is one that is munachas bebeis genazav, one is that is held in his home, and it's always going to be there. So he always needs to have a Sefer Torah. Now ask the Gemara, what happens if I was the prince, and now my father is no longer able to serve as the king, and rightfully so, I am now deserving of that position of leadership, and I become the king, but my father already commissioned the Sefer Torah to be written when he became the king. So do I have to go through the whole process again? Writes the Gemara, yes. Afal pi shehinichu lo aviv sefer Torah. Even if my father was the king, and he left over a Sefer Torah, and he's not going to use it anymore. He's not the king either because he died or because he's unable to serve. And now I became the king, says the Gemara, mitzvah lo sheyichtov mishalo. The new king, when he takes upon the mantle of leadership, has to write his own Sefer Torah. My father told us as children that it's not only a halacha that is relevant to a king, but he said it's relevant to every Jew. Even if one's father wrote a beautiful Sefer Torah, mitzvah lo sheyichtov mishalo. And what I took out of that is, our parents may have written a tremendous Sefer Torah for us. At least my father wrote a tremendous Sefer Torah in the figurative way. And our parents may have left over a tremendous legacy for us. But af al pi shehinichu lo aviv Sefer Torah, we all have a job to write our own. To spend our lives figuring out, what does the Torah mean to me? What does the Ribono Shel Olam mean to me? And it is irrelevant that our parents may have had a genuine connection, an important connection, something that was real. That makes no difference to the life that I live and to the relationship that I need to develop and that I need to think about. We start our Shemona Esrei every day by saying Elokei Avram, Elokei Yitzchak, Velokei Yaakov. And one of the Mefarshim asks, why don't we streamline the process and just say Elokei Avram Yitzchak V'Yaakov? And the answer is because the God that Avram Avinu had a relationship with was not the God that Yitzchak made a relationship with. Because Yitzchak understood, my father did certain things in his life to build that relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but I'm given the opportunity to connect with him in a different way, and I have to make sure that I make this God mine. Ultimately, HaKadosh Baruch Hu became not just the Elokei Avram Yitzchak V'Yaakov, he became the God personally of Avram Avinu. It meant something to him. He became the God, once again, of Yitzchak in his own way. And Yaakov Avinu said, yes, I had a great father and I had a great grandfather. And they were amazing personalities. And God felt very close with them and he even communicated with both of them. But Yaakov says, it's my job to create a situation of Elokei Yaakov. Has to be personal to me. And we start our Shemona Esrei with that every day. Understand that wherever you come from, you have the opportunity not just to have ancestors who believed in God, not just ancestors who made a relationship with God, but this God can be Elokei Shai Shechter. This God can be the God of me, personally. And it's my job to figure out what that's going to mean. It's my job to figure out how I'm going to cultivate that relationship and what the relationship will mean to me and what it will mean, ultimately, to HaKadosh Baruch Hu as well. That is the challenge that we have, but that is something that we learn from Shemaya Ve'Avtalyum. Doesn't matter where you come from, and it works in both directions. You can come from a family that has a long-standing tradition, a very close connection to God, and it's not necessarily going to carry through to the children. It is the job of every child and every adult to make sure that they figure it out on their own, to develop and to cultivate and build a relationship with the Ribono Shel Olam. And on the opposite spectrum, you can come from a family that has no connection at all or from a family of Gerim. And you are given equal opportunity to be a self-made human being who can grow and can rise to become like Shemaya Ve'Avtalyon, the Nasi and the Av Beis Din. So now let us learn the first statement of Shemaya. Again, with that very short introduction, let us begin. I somehow seem to do this often. So let's see. This is why a year and a half into this project, we're only 10 Mishnayos in. This is what happens. But I hope it's okay. So now that we know about Shemaya, what did Shemaya say? The first statement that he tells us is, Ehov es hamelacha. We're going to save the rest for another week. Ehov es hamelacha. What does it mean? Ehov es hamelacha, writes the Bar Tanura. Bar Tanura is probably the most important commentary on the Mishnayos. And he writes, what it means is, afilu yesh lo bameh lehisparnes, even if I have enough money, even if I am retired, let us say, chayiv lasuk bimelacha, I still need to keep myself busy. Don't raise your hands. But how many people in this room had a spouse who perhaps retired, and you went nuts after they retired, okay? Why is that? What happens? Shouldn't life be blissful? Now my spouse is retired, And we have so much time to go out to dinner together and to go out to lunch, and we could go on our walks in the morning, and life is lovely. And that sometimes doesn't happen. Why? Because when people don't have a structure, when people don't have a malacha to be busy with, writes the Bar Tanur, quoting a Gemara, Batala mevia lide shiyumum. A person who sits around without something to do goes insane, and their life becomes absolute absurdity. And therefore the Mishnah says, Ahov is amalacha. Yes, life is hard, and sometimes we need to work hard to accomplish goals, but that is what real, rich living and life is all about. And says Shemaya, don't ever take the easy way out. Even if, writes the Bar Tanura, Yesh lo bamele hisparnes, I retired, I sold my company, millions of dollars, I'm good to go for the next 50, 60, 100 years. Don't rely on that. Find something new to do. And understand that if you don't do that, you're going to go crazy. Chazal say, it's an amazing medrash. We have a pasuk, I'm happy that everyone's in agreement here. Sheshes yamim tavod. We know that the Torah says, Sheshes yamim tavod, we have an obligation to work 6 days. And then the Torah says, V'yom ha-shvi shabbos la-Hashem Elokecha. So we all read that pasuk to mean that God has instructed us to keep Shabbos. But Chazal say that's not the whole equation. Look at the beginning of the pasuk where we're told, you are mandated, Sheshes yamim tavod. 6 days a week you should keep yourself busy. And then on the seventh day, you should observe the Shabbos. Because if a person does not understand that life is about working, it's about producing, it's about being involved, it's about putting myself out there, making a schedule, making sure I have something to do, then Shabbos will be meaningless as well. What does it mean to rest on the seventh day if you've been resting all week long? So the Torah says, first of all, the prerequisite is, Sheshes yamim tavod. Spend your life wisely. Work all those 6 days of the week, and then you will appreciate Shabbos. Shabbos la'Hashem Elokecha. You will have the appropriate respite that you need. So I read an article a few weeks ago that was printed in The Atlantic. As Chatay Ani Mazkir, I like to read articles. But the topic, the title of the article was, how much leisure time do the happiest people have? You know, I work backwards. Maybe I'm crazy. But sometimes I read an article and it spurs me what to talk about. From there, I build a shear. Maybe it's a backwards way of thinking. But sometimes when I see something relevant or interesting, it makes me think about what is the Torah's perspective on this issue. So that's what I thought about here. I read this article and it says, how much leisure time do the happiest people have? It intrigued me. I'm curious. How much leisure time do the happiest people have? And then the subtitle is, too little and people tend to get stressed. Too much and people tend to feel idle. So it's complicated, and they write, up and down the economic ladder, many Americans who work, and especially those who are raising kids, are pressed for time, wishing that they had more of it to devote to leisure activities or even just to sleeping a little more. At the same time, research has indicated that people who are busy tend to be happier than those who are idle, whether their busyness is purposeful or not. The article goes on, and it's not important for us, but I was very intrigued by that. The research shows today that those who are busy tend to be happier than those who are not. And that is so strange. But it makes a lot of sense. I don't know if you ever feel this way, but let's say in the month of January when our schedule is a little bit lighter for this year because everybody's on vacation and people are in and out, so I have a little bit more time to myself for like a week, and I always find I am so much more exhausted during the month of January when I'm off, not really off, but when I'm a lighter schedule than I am during a regular week. Every night I don't get to sleep before 1 o'clock. People are calling, people are busy, I have to respond to everyone's emails, it's crazy. I responded to somebody's email the other night, he says, why are you responding at 12 o'clock at night? I said, you just sent me the email at 11. What did you think I was going to do? I would rather get it out of the way and respond than have to have another thing to do tomorrow morning when I wake up. So we all lead busy lives, and I go to sleep very late, and I wake up early. I have young children. There is no option. And I'm not so exhausted. I have energy. A person who is busy somehow finds the energy to do what they need to do. Now, sometimes we collapse. Sometimes we're exhausted, and it's too much. But for the most part, we all lead very busy lives, and we somehow figure it out. And I always find when I'm off, I'm so tired. I take a nap during the day. Like, this is great. And I wake up and I'm just not even refreshed. I'm so tired. How does that happen? Because batala mevia lidei shiyumim. When you have too much time in your hands, it doesn't lead to anything good. Rabbeinu Bechaya ibn Pekuda, not to be confused with Rabbeinu Bechaya on Chumash. He was one of the great Spanish philosophers, lived in the 11th century, wrote the Sefer Chovas HaLevavos. Chovas HaLevavos is one of the most important books on Jewish philosophy, and he writes, how do we deal with this issue? Let's read it together. Ha'ila asher ba'avura chiev ha'boreis ha'adam lachzor u'lesavev al sibos ha'teref u'shar ma'sha hu tzarich elav. Why is it that God made us work so hard to be able to provide for ourselves and our families? You ever wonder, there are some people, I don't know if anyone has family members here, who go to such extreme lengths to make a parnasa. Some people's jobs, okay, they go to the city every day, wherever their office might be, they figure it out. Some people have to go to such extremes to make a parnasa. They're flying all over the world, and they go from meetings here and meetings there, and you wonder, my goodness, what is the rebuttal? And it's not like they're making millions of dollars. They're just making a living, trying to support their family. Why does the Ribono Shel Olam make people work so hard? And forgetting about those people who have to travel all over the world, what about regular average people who don't have to do that? So you have a job, but I still have to figure out every day, I got to figure out what I'm serving, you know, my kids for dinner, and when am I going to go to the supermarket? How am I going to get all these doctor's appointments finished? Again, the life of a younger family has these concerns. I assume as your family grows, you have new things to worry about. And it's just getting through the week. There's so many things on our heads. Why did the Ribono Shel Olam make it this way? Why can't we just have one central place in the middle of town where all the doctors are going to be, where all the supermarkets will be? I'll have to make one stop every day, and they'll have valet parking. I won't have to worry about it. And just life will be so much easier. And it will save so much time. We'll save so much time. What do I need this for? All this headache figuring out. I have to go here and go there and figure out this and figure out that. How many times a week do you go to Gourmet Glot, by the way? By us, it's never once. So, 5 times, pretty good. Not bad. So, this year is sponsored by Gourmet Glot. Anyway, so, Chovas HaLevavos writes, why does HaKadosh Baruch Hu set up the world in this way? What is the point? Why wouldn't He just make our lives easier? So he writes, one reason, which we're not going to focus on, but Hasheni, let's read it together. He says the second reason is Ki ilu lo hutzrach ha'adam l'tzroach v'lachzor u'lesavev l'havas tarfo. If I did not have to work hard to bring home what I need to provide for myself and those who are close with me, hayaboet v'rodev achar ha'averos, I would have too much time and it would lead me to do evil things. Writes the Chovas HaLevavos, I would never stop and think about how grateful I should be for the life that I have, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave me this life. Writes the Chovas HaLevavos, we have a pasuk in Sefer Yeshaya. The Navi Yeshaya is describing a utopian existence, and it talks about somebody who's sitting down to dinner, and he has the violinist playing there, and he has a whole orchestra playing right next to him, and it's so relaxing, and it's so beautiful, and he brings out the very expensive wines, v'yayel mishteh, I'm not making it up, that's what he says. Ves poel Hashem lo yabitu u'maisa yadav lo ro. You can be living this perfect, beautiful, extravagant life. Ves maase Hashem lo yadu. Ves poel Hashem lo yabitu. You never bother to think for a moment that God is the one who gave you all of this. Why? Because I'm living the perfect dream. Why would I ever think about God? Where does He come into this picture? Life is perfect. Life is great. And he goes on and on to explain why this is important. Go to the last line here. V'haya mechemlas habore. A great gift that God gave us was shehetrido be'inyane olamo v'achriso. That God said, the way the world is going to work is, you need to work hard to be able to have the life that you want to have. Now, it doesn't always work out. We can work hard and sometimes we still don't have what we want. But says the Chovas HaLevavos, this was a gift. Listen to the perspective. This was a gift that God gave us, that we need to work for what we have. L'his'asek kol yemei chaya b'zeh. That we should be busy in our lives. V'lo yivakesh Masha Eino Tzarech Lo. This past Shabbos, my sister made a bar mitzvah in Bergenfield. This coming Shabbos, my brother's making a bar mitzvah in Toronto. So, it's great. So, I was in Bergenfield for Shabbos, and I had the opportunity on Shabbos afternoon to sit by Mincha next to Moshe Tzvi Weinberg. For anybody who knows him, he's a rabbi in Teaneck. And he said to me, "Nu, what's the shir on this coming week?" He often listens online, so he said, "What are we in for?" So I told him, "I'm going to talk about this Mishnah, Ahavas HaMalach." I said, "Tell me something that I should add into the shir." So he did, and he gave me a great Maror Makom, which after Shabbos he very graciously took pictures of. Not just he told me where to look, he took pictures of it and sent it to me, which was very helpful. There's a beautiful set of Svarim in English, and I encourage anyone who doesn't have it or has never seen it, I encourage you to buy at least one of the volumes. They sell them separately. The Insights of Rav Pam on Chumash. I happen to love it. I don't have it at home. I never bought the set, but we have it upstairs in Shul. That's where I first saw it. And it's a really amazing set of Svarim. It's in English. Everything is very down to earth, clear messages, very appropriate and very relevant to our lives, taken straight from the Pesukim and Chumash. You don't have to do hoops to figure out where he got it from. It's very clear, and I find them very insightful. So Rabbi Moshe Tzvi Weinberg showed me that there's a beautiful insight of Rav Pam on Parshas Noach. I had never seen it before, but an amazing insight. And Rav Pam writes that you will notice if you look at the end of, say, Parshas Bereishis, Noach's father's name was Lemech. He's a figure we don't generally think about because he's not so relevant. His son was a very prominent personality, but his father was Lemech. Now here you are, you just have a child, and you're trying to figure out, you know, you have a discussion, the couple is figuring out, what are we going to name our child? Let's call him Noach. What does Noach mean? You know, we've come to accept this as a normal name, but what does Noach mean? Rest. Huh, let's name our child Rest. Why would he name your child Rest? What a crazy name. So the Torah tells us why he named his child Rest. And I'm going to translate in English what the Torah says. And Lemech called the name of his son Noach, saying, "This one will comfort us from our toil and from the anguish of our hands, from the soil that God has cursed." Therefore he named his son Noach. Now we probably don't recognize this because we read it Parshas Bereishis right after Sukkot. Who's paying attention? But it's a small detail, but it's a very important detail. Why was Noach called Noach? Because he was going to relieve the entire world of the cursed atmosphere that they lived in. What is that a reference to? So the Medrash explains. What it means is that after Adam HaRishon does the fateful sin in Gan Eden, so we know he was cursed, Bezeas HaPecha Toch HaLechem. Life is going to be difficult, horrible for you from here on in. And then the Medrash says, Adam HaRishon was promised this is going to go on for 10 generations, and then someone's going to be born, and that person, after 10 generations, when he is born, is going to bring solace to the world. He's going to bring a reprieve. Noach was the 10th generation. He's born. His father says, "Great, here he is." The Medrash explains how he knew that Noach was the right child. But anyway, he says, this is going to be the one who's going to relieve the world of this horrible life that we live. Okay. The Medrash goes on to explain, until Noach's generation, do you know how they would plant, how they would work the fields? With their hands. Gross. Can you imagine? Not just disgusting. Can you imagine how much time that took? Every time you wanted to plant a seed, you had to dig out the ground by yourself. And imagine if you were planting a tree, so it has to be deeper into the ground. You have to dig it out with your own 10 fingers, put the seed in, then push everything back. It was disgusting and so time-consuming. And Noach comes along and he says, this really is not an efficient way to run our produce, our agriculture. I have an idea. And he comes up with a brilliant invention called a shovel. And the Medrash says, he is the first one in history who came up with all the tools necessary to have a successful agricultural society. All of that was the doing of Noach. So he actually did bring tremendous comfort to the world. Can you imagine? Used to be everybody who worked on the fields, can you imagine how much time it took to plant anything and to harvest and to do everything by hand? And Noach came up with all these instruments. That was all his chiddush. That was his idea. Writes Rav Pam, although the Medrash states that Noach made life much easier and made society far more economically productive, it was precisely in Noach's time that society became corrupt and debased. What an amazing insight. Apparently, there is a correlation between hard work and the moral status of the world, between having it easy and moral deterioration. That is an incredibly powerful insight. Finally, when Noach comes up with the system and he saves people hours and hours of time every week, now the world goes astray. Now the world becomes an atrocious reality that is so stooped in immorality and criminality and terrible things that were going on in the days of the Mabul. Such corruption, such depravity, and yet That all happened at the time when Noach made life easier? Does that make sense, writes Rav Palm? Yes, it makes sense. That's a direct correlation. That's what happens. And he says, we live in such an advanced world. We have so many conveniences. And look what is happening to us. I think often about the invention of the computer. So I am on my laptop all the time. I'm on my phone all the time. I actually was upset for anyone who has an iPhone and you get the iOS updates every so often. So about a year ago, I clicked on it. I said, okay, I want the update. And the update had a new feature, which probably is good, but I feel so horrible every time I look at it, the screen time. So it shows you at the end of every week how much time you spent on your phone. And I felt so awful. Every time I look at that and it shows this amount of hours, I'm saying to myself, how in the world do I spend this much time on my phone? What am I doing? So I get it. People call on the phone, I have to respond. People send emails, I got to write back. I get it. But what about the rest of the time? So yes, it's true. Computers have made our lives so convenient, and you can shop online, you can do so many things that you otherwise would take so much longer to take care of, but yet, look how much time we waste because of it. So we have this amazing advancement in technology that has made our lives so much more efficient, but look at the counter. Look what has happened as a result. Yes, a lot of wonderful things, a lot of Torah learning, a lot of wonderful communication that we otherwise would not have. But look how much evil has come out of this, because people have so much time. People now have so much more time than they used to have, and look how they spend it. Writes Rav Palm, that is a direct correlation. When life becomes easier, when people have nothing to do, this is what happens. I always think about this. Yom Tov is an amazing time. How many families have terrible fighting over Yom Tov? During the rest of the year, we're so busy we don't have time to think about how angry we are at another family member. We don't think about it. We don't care. I have better things to worry about, and now I have a 3-day Yom Tov. 3-day Yom Tov. And all I'm doing is, not all I'm doing, but I'm sitting and eating one meal after the other, with no major responsibility. Obviously, we're cooking, and we're providing, and we're setting up, and we're cleaning up, and it's hard. But for the most part, we're sitting around. And when we sit around with not much to do, this is what happens. This is what happens. That's exactly what Rav Palm says. I think it's such a powerful insight. And it's so true. Not only that, Rav Shamsher and Fall Hirsch writes in his commentary on Chumash, what was God's response after the Mabul? So you look at the sheet here, number Dalet, HaKadosh Baruch Hu promised, Lo Osif Od Lekalel Es HaAdama Ba'avur HaAdam. I am not going to curse the land again like I just did and I destroyed the world with the Mabul. Ki Yetzer Lev HaAdam Rami Ne'urav. I understand, I created man with this evil inclination. So this is really my fault, God says. Obviously, we all make decisions, but God created us this way. So he says, therefore, you're going to suffer a consequence, but not of this kind of proportion. I'm not going to destroy the world again with a Mabul. And then the Torah says, Od kol yemei haaretz, from here on in, the world is going to run differently. We're going to have zera, v'katzer, v'kor, v'chom, v'kayetz, v'choref, v'yom, v'layla, lo yishbosu. From here on in, God says, we are going to have seasons of the year. So what does that mean? What did the world used to look like? The world was California weather all year long. Without the fires. So the world was every day you woke up to this blissful reality. And it was perfect. And what can possibly be wrong? And my life was beautiful. And what could I complain about? Because every morning I woke up. You know, we were thinking, before we moved to the Young Israel of Woodmere, I was offered a position in Los Angeles. And we were very seriously considering it. And somebody said to me, you know, there's something missing, and this is an overgeneralization, and I'm not talking negatively about anyone, but somebody there said, you don't want to move here. I said, why not? What's the problem? This is beautiful. He said, the problem is there's something missing. I said, what's missing? The people here in Los Angeles have never had to wake up in the morning and shovel their car out from the snow. So they don't know what it means to live anything less than a utopian, perfect, beautiful, sublime reality. And therefore, if you're going to come in here and expect them to change any part of that reality that they like, that's just a recipe for a disaster. That's what he told me. Very interesting. This was told to me by a resident of California who used to live in New York. And again, it's a funny comment that he made, and I don't mean it as a negative to anybody, but that's the way the world was. It used to be beautiful every day. Gan Eden. It's great. And now HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, this is not going to be the world anymore. From here on in, we're going to have seasons. Sometimes it's going to be cold, sometimes it's going to be warm, and it's going to rain, and it's going to have storms. And this is the way reality is going to exist from here on in. V'yom v'layla lo yishbosu. And why was that necessary, writes Rav Hirsch? Because this is the way to make sure that human beings don't get out of control. If life is going to be this sublime, perfect, utopian existence every day, can you imagine what would happen? And HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, not healthy. We don't want that. It was a mistake. From here on in, we're going to have seasons. And sometimes it's going to be difficult to go outside. And sometimes it's going to be cold. And yes, sometimes you're going to have to shovel your car out from the snow. That's the way the world should be, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says. Because look what happens. When I gave everybody too much free time, when I made life easier for them because Noah streamlined the process of agricultural society, when now they had too much on their hands that they were able to just figure out, what am I going to do today? And life is so beautiful and everything's so blissful. Look what happened. Look where it led them. To a horrible destruction of an immoral world. Reb Shamsher Mufal Hirsch writes, God said, I'm not going to allow this to happen again. And that is why this was the immediate response to the Mabul. Take for another example. We're going to close in another 5 minutes, but take for another example. The Jewish people are traveling in the desert. Most obvious problem. What are we going to eat? So here they are in the desert, and there is nothing growing in the desert, and they're not able to plant anything. It's just not the right conditions. You can't eat a cactus. So what are they going to do? So the Torah says immediately when they start traveling in the desert, they hurl a complaint against Moshe Rabbeinu, and they criticize him. Vayomer Elehem b'nei Yisrael. Look at number hey. The Jewish people complain to Moshe and Aaron, Mi yitein musenu b'yad Hashem b'eretz Mitzrayim? B'shivtenu al sir habasar? At least when we were in Egypt, we were being oppressed, but at least we had something to eat. Ba'achalnu lechem lasova, ki hotseisem osanu el hamidbar hazeh, lahamis eskal hakahal hazeh barav. What are you doing? You lead us into a desert, and we have nothing to eat. What's the plan? What are we going to do? And God responds, and he says the following. Next line. Vayomer Hashem al Moshe. God says, you have a good point. What are we going to do? How are they going to survive? I'll tell you. Hineni mamti lachem lechem in hashamayim. Don't worry, the man is coming. Now what is the man? Nobody ever heard of man. But don't worry, something's going to fall from heaven. Vayatzaham v'liktu dvar yom b'yomo. And every day, every family is going to have to go out and gather enough food for their families. Leman anasenu. God says this is all as a challenge, as a test. Hayelech b'sorasi imlo. Are they going to follow the rules of the Torah or not? Now what is the challenge? Rashi and all the Rishonim are bothered. What is the challenge here? That's perfect. Can you imagine if you woke up every day and there was a gourmet glatt delivery outside of your house, everything that you needed, exactly what you need, not that we're not sure, everything exactly the way I need it, and not even that I'm going to have to work to make it later. It was ready-made, everything prepared. Life would be amazing. What is the challenge? What is the test? So Rashi says, well, the test here was that there were certain restrictions, certain regulations about how you were allowed to treat them up. So it says you're not allowed to leave it over till the next morning, and you have to take only what's for your family. So God said, well, I'm going to test you. Are you going to be able to stick to the rules or not? That was the test. The Ramban says, no, I don't believe that that was the test. The test was a challenge in Emuna and Bitachon. Can you imagine? I have a family of 6, 7 children, and I have nothing to eat. And I wake up in the morning, and now there's man. And I say to myself, okay, we're going to make it through today. What am I going to do tomorrow? I don't know that the same miracle is going to happen. How many times can a miracle happen? The Ramban says, that's the test. Do you believe in God that you have the ultimate belief that this is going to repeat itself every single day? That, says the Ramban, was the test of the month. A little hard to understand because maybe the first week or the second week or the first month of the first year. But 39 years later, when I'm having this every single day without fail, it probably wasn't such a test anymore. And the Aruch Haim HaKadosh says, no, you all got it wrong. It was not the test of the rules and regulations of the man. It was not the test of whether or not I'm going to have bitachon and amuna, but rather, it was a test of, now that I've made life so simple for you and you don't have to do a thing, and I gave you the man, and I'm going to give you a be'er, you don't have to go to the well to draw water, and I'm going to protect you with the anani hakavod, and you don't have to fend off your enemies, and life is perfect. And you have nothing else to do. The question is, what are you going to do with your time? How are you going to behave? Hayelech b'sorasiyim lo? Are you going to be able to uphold an ethical standard of life when you have nothing that should be on your mind at all? That, writes the Aruch Chaim HaKadosh, is the ultimate test. That was the test of the man. And that is the test of a person who HaKadosh Baruch Hu provides for. How will you spend the gift of time? What will you do with the time that I give you? That is what Shmaya v'Avtalion teach us in this Mishnah. Ehov es hamalacha. Appreciate the fact that we are all expected to work hard in life. It's a gift. There's a reason for it. HaKadosh Baruch Hu created our lives and designed them in this way for a very particular purpose, for a reason. Because it was a chesed elyon, writes the Chovos HaLevavos. He did it because he wanted to make sure that we don't have too much free time. When people have too much free time, look what happens. Such destruction, such devastation. And I believe maybe this is not 100% correct, but maybe it's a thought to consider. Why is Shemaya specifically the one who says, Ahov es hamalacha? You know why? Because as we mentioned, to tie the beginning to the end, Shemaya was a self-made man. Shemaya was a ger, the Gemara says. Shemaya was not born into this. Shemaya earned everything that he had in his life through the hard work and through the investment that he was willing to put in, and he understood Ehov es hamalacha. And if you're willing to work hard and you're willing to invest in the life that you live, look what can happen. You can be a person who is never supposed to be the Nasi because I am a ger and I don't belong having that position, but I worked so hard in my life to a point where I elevated myself and I soared to a level where I have no equal. And there is nobody else who can fill this position other than me. And Shmaya ultimately, because of his hard work, because of his investment, ended up ascending to become the Nasi. And Avtalion became the Av Bezdin. Why? Because they understood and they appreciated the value of Ehov es hamalacha. Appreciate what it means to work hard. Understand that if you work hard, you can go places. And great things can happen. That is the lesson of Shmaya v'Avtalion. Number one, doesn't matter where you come from. Doesn't matter what kind of parents, what kind of school, what kind of upbringing you had or didn't have. Life is in our hands to make a decision and to make a choice of how we are going to spend it. And number two, Shmaya teaches us, Ehov es hamalacha. You invest all that you have to work hard in life and to accomplish great things. Great things will happen. You can end up being the Nasi, figurative Nasi. You can accomplish things that nobody ever believed would happen in your lifetime. And the way to do that is by appreciating the time that we have and using it to work hard and to accomplish the goals that we have set out for ourselves, even if others may not believe they can ever happen. Amir Tzashem, next week, we